I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells.
About residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there.
And the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle. Stories about life on the inside, told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
Support for WABE's local coverage on maternal health and mortality comes from Georgia Health Initiative, whose mission is to inspire and promote collective action that advances health equity for all Georgians. Learn more at GeorgiaHealthInitiative.org.
This is Buried Truths. I'm Hank Klibanoff. I received an email one day from the library in my hometown, Florence, Alabama. Oh boy, I thought. They're finally catching up with me. They're looking for that biography of Hank Aaron I checked out in elementary school and never returned. But the email was actually a lovely invitation to bring Buried Truths to town, my hometown, and record an episode there. I kind of like that idea. As I chatted with the library folks, I mentioned something that's often been on my mind in the many years since I left Florence for college and career. It was something that started as an observation, actually a memory that I really couldn't swear was true, and which became a theory that I couldn't prove. On this special episode, recorded before a live audience at the Florence Lauderdale Public Library, we're going to explore that something. Now, let me begin by locating Florence. It's way up in the top left-hand corner of the state of Alabama and sits along the Tennessee River. The town probably reached 30,000 people when I was growing up and is at about 40,000 now. There's much to talk and brag about in Florence and in the greater Muscle Shoals region of northwest Alabama, where Florence is situated. And my memory, which is what we're about to test here, is that the Shoals region of the state, and Florence in particular, on matters of racial attitudes and race relations, were by most measures more progressive than the rest of Alabama. Now, I say that with a lot of pride. Now, I want to be clear about what I'm not saying. I'm not feeling woozy from the glint of moonlight and the scent of magnolias. I'm not saying there was no racism or complete absence of racial violence. We did have two lynchings, two that we know about, back in 1883 and 1907. And surely there were some racially motivated beatings and attacks that we'll never know about. As late as 1968, we had what may have been a double murder of an interracial couple that the sheriff and police said was a murder-suicide. It was the way the sheriff described it that only exacerbated doubts about law enforcement's conclusion. "There's only one thing I have to say," the sheriff told a reporter. "There's a dead white woman and a dead," and here he used the N-word, "and it's all water over the dam." Now, when I began paying attention to these things in the mid-1950s, I took special note of the distinctive sound and appearances of racism because I only ever heard them outside my home. The N-word, often used in cruel jokes, spilled quite easily from kids my age, mostly boys. This was the American South. We may have been almost 100 years removed from the Civil War, yet black people still reflexively lowered their head, averted their eyes, sagged their shoulders, and went to pains to look non-threatening. But I also saw, because I watched my dad as he walked downtown, black and white people strike up friendly "how's your mama" conversations and share complaints about the heat. We were not Birmingham, or Montgomery, or Selma, or Marion, Gadsden, Tuscaloosa, or other Alabama towns that became datelines on major stories about dogs and fire hoses, bombings, burnings, shootings, and other violent confrontations. Over time in Alabama, black deference turned justifiably to rebellion against the established racial rigidity, and the rebellion became a full-blown movement. And then as white resistance rose up in violent, bloody opposition, I had the impression that the Shoals region was both fully segregated, as required by state law, but also more tolerant and open-minded. Now, as you may know or may have surmised, I'm a white man. So what do I really know? As sensitive as I'd like to think I am, I'll say this. I don't know what I don't know. And I cannot possibly know if that was the black experience around me then, or if my memory and perception is shared by my black contemporaries. And I won't know unless I ask. So that's what I'm going to do in this episode. I'm going to bring into the conversation some people, black and white, with whom I shared the common experience of school desegregation in my hometown in the late 1960s. A shared experience, but from entirely different perspectives. As Florence residents gathered and claimed seats inside the book-filled library, I took the stage with my delightful co-host for the evening, Sharonda Allen, an editor at the local newspaper, The Times Daily. Sharonda was also born and raised here and is widely known and highly regarded in town. The audience in front of us can tell, but you cannot. Sharonda is black, and as I told you, I am white. Right away, Sharonda and I seem to be on the same page.
I'm just thrilled to be on this stage with you, Hank, and I'm thrilled to see so many people who are just as concerned, I hope, as we are in having a civil and very informative discussion about race relations here. We didn't have, you know, hosing down people and all the violence that a lot of the world associates with Alabama, fortunately. But I love that you want to examine what else was going on. So I look forward to examining that with you.
Good, thank you. So the question we're examining here is this. Really? Were we really less hostile and less defensive and less belligerent? Were we less racist? Or is this just what we white people sometimes do? We think it was all working out pretty well, when in fact our black neighbors were suffering the brunt and the blunt abuse of racism. So what was that all about back then in our past? How did the racial divide, the heat, and the intensity affect us then? And how does it affect us now? So we're recording this as an episode of Buried Truths. And we're recording this and we're doing this because of a basic belief, and the belief goes like this. When we understand who we were, we can better understand who we are.
One thing we all had in common, black and white, was that the state of Alabama was not going to let us go into racially integrated schools when the Supreme Court ordered it. That was in 1954 in the Brown versus Board decision. The white South bought some time a year later, 1955, when the Supreme Court justices further explained they wanted compliance with all deliberate speed. To white Alabama, it meant, well, we don't have to do this until we're damn well ready. So they didn't. Public schools in my hometown did not start integrating until 1966. That's 12 years after the Brown decision. Instead of starting when I was entering the first grade, integration began when I was in the 11th grade. I invited a local scholar to join us. She's Dr. Ansley Quiros, an associate professor of history at the University of North Alabama. She told me about some research that she thinks provides a clue as to whether the Shoals area was more progressive on race.
Yeah, so along with a colleague, Dr. Brian Dempsey, we've been conducting some research under the auspices of the National Park Service. They had a series of African American civil rights grants. And we sort of took up this same question. Is this mythology that the Shoals was more progressive than the rest of the state accurate? And if so, what does that mean? And so we've found that mostly, in terms of the data, the Shoals is different. And that becomes the most clear when you look at data about desegregation. So in the mid-60s, in 1965, 1966, the Shoals area, Colbert County and Lauderdale County, adopts voluntarily a freedom of choice plan in terms of school desegregation, which is not totally unheard of in the South. It also was not totally a freedom of choice, but it did give families an opportunity to desegregate. And in this area, about 10% did. So what that means is what you have is about 10% of students were going to integrated schools. They call that Negroes enrolled with whites. Compared to the rest of the state, the average is 0.5%. Birmingham is 0.15%. And so this area does seem to have voluntarily desegregated somewhat, but at a much greater rate than the rest of the state. Part of the reason is because African Americans in those counties are never a majority that's threatening to take over those schools in a meaningful way. That's also true with the voting data. So the numbers of black registered voters in this area are much higher, up around 20%, some as high as 28%. But again, in raw data, the total black vote is going to be less than 10%, which is a stark contrast with places like Birmingham or places in South Alabama, where giving black Americans the right to vote would have constituted a power-threatening majority. So we do see that in some ways the demographics uphold that.
So let me summarize what we know so far. We know that the Shoals area had a smaller percentage of black people than most of the rest of the state. But blacks in the Shoals area enrolled in previously all-white schools at a considerably higher rate than in most of the rest of the state. And when it came to voter registration, blacks in the Shoals area were registered at a much higher percentage than in other parts of Alabama.
So what that means is that the white power structure in the Shoals is able in some ways to allow, and whether it's tokenism in a negative way or a real effort at some sort of progressivism is up for debate, but they are able to allow for some sense of desegregation, some sense of voting, because it's not a fatal threat to white supremacy in a meaningful way, which is very different than the rest of the state.
Thank you.
Before we go deeper into this, I need to give you some explanations. Throughout most of Florence history, that is, about 150 of my hometown's 200 years, black people and white people, by law, attended separate schools. We had two high schools, a black school named Burl Slater, almost walking distance from my house, and a white one, Coffee High, which my father and aunt and older sisters had attended and where I would go. My senior year, 1967, the town added a third high school in a white section of town named Bradshaw. 3 years after we started the phased desegregation, that is in 1969, the black high school, Burl Slater, closed. But back to the evening at the library, where we were discussing race relations in the 1960s. I have just introduced one of our guests, Shirley Douglas. She was one of the first African Americans to desegregate the public school system when she moved from Burl Slater. She was also the first African American cheerleader at Coffee High School, and she now works at the Florence High School in the counseling department.
So take us back to what year that was that you went to Coffee.
In that particular time, it was a freedom of choice, and we had a choice to visit the different schools, and we visited Bradshaw and Coffee, and all of the blacks decided that they wanted to go to Coffee for some reason. Everybody liked Coffee. And we could not all go to Coffee, so freedom of choice didn't work, so they said, okay, we're giving the seniors the choice. All the seniors could go to Coffee, and all the juniors had to go to Bradshaw. Sophomores could go to Coffee, and that's the way it went. So
Shirley Douglas had been a cheerleader at Burl Slater. So rather than force her to compete against white girls for cheerleader at Coffee, where of course she would be vastly outnumbered, school administrators hand-selected her for the one spot reserved for a black student that first year. When she'd go out on the football field to cheer, she'd see her parents in their car down near the field, and an ambulance there. Presumably, she thought, in case a player got seriously injured. She'd also see a very nice policeman.
And then there was this police officer that always was in front of me, smiling, you know, it was like, and I would go, hi, you know, and he was always like, how are you today? And I'm like, I'm okay, you know, and everything. And I never knew that until after I had graduated from high school, went to college, came back, and I was told that every time we had a ball game, that it was a threat. A threat was made that, you know, they said we were gonna kill that little colored girl that was out there cheering on the field. And my parents never told me, but they were always at every ball game, every home game, as I said, they were at the stadium, pulled in by the ambulance. Mm-hmm. And see, it was never publicized, so it didn't hit the papers, so it was not like the dogs in Birmingham, you know, and putting the dogs on or whatever. It was never just publicized, so therefore, you know, it
was. And did the other cheerleaders, how accepting were they?
They were very accepting. Everything mm-hmm. was great. It mm-hmm. was just, I mean, you know, we had went to each other's, and we went to their houses. They would pick me up for cheerleader practice. We would carpool. We would go different places and everything. And it was so ironic that we went to Huntsville, the big city of Huntsville, and we were at Shoney's, and the waitress came, and she decided to take everybody's order but mine. And one of the mothers said, well, if you can't take her order, then we're not good enough to eat here. Let's go eat somewhere else. Okay. And that really, you know, made me feel really good. So it was just really a great experience.
Do you remember any cheers?
I remember one we did for Sheffield.
Yeah.
You see,
yeah.
Sheffield High School was Coffey's main rival from across the river.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I can't do it. Sheffield, think they're it. SH for Sheffield. IT for it. So.
I got it. Okay.
Forget yeah. that one.
Yeah, now you are going to, we need an ambulance here, you know.
Okay.
Inside Coffey, though, I just want to go a little bit further. Just day in, day out, everyone was accepting, or you did have some who sort of steered away or wouldn't shake hands or wouldn't whatever kids do?
Never had that problem.
And what do you think explains that?
I don't know if it was the students were prepped for it or whatever, but we never had that problem. Mm-hmm. Never. I mean, the N-word was never even brought up. Mm-hmm. Never. I mean, we ate in the cafeteria. It wasn't the blacks on one side, whites on one side. We all ate together. It was never, you know, where mm-hmm. we were segregated. You know,
okay.
They're more segregated now in mm-hmm. the cafeterias than we were back then.
Mm-hmm.
I'm finding this very fascinating because you look at old photos of those days of integration and you see the angry faces shouting, the white faces shouting at the black faces, mm-hmm. and you had none of that at Coffey.
We had none of that at Coffey.
Okay.
It was just really... It was a great time. I mean, my high school years, I look back at my high school years, and they were really great. Our basketball team and football teams were, you know, we didn't have the greatest of the teams. We didn't mm-hmm. win many games, mm-hmm. but we played them.
There was so much pride, and even now when anyone talks about Burl Slater, mm-hmm. there is so much pride in the fact that Burl Slater existed and was there and had, you know, students going to Burl. How did you feel about leaving Burl Slater?
At first, we felt really sad about leaving, but our teachers left with us. The teachers that we really liked left with us and came to Coffey.
Didn't and, feel so alone going.
Yeah, right, we didn't feel alone. And
now let me
the
jump
principal
in here
at that
to
time
mention
at Coffey,
that Shirley is about to tell a story that surprised me. It's about someone I had known many years, Ralph Smith, and I knew him because his wife was my sixth grade teacher and because he was my coach. And I remembered him as an abrupt, acerbic, hard-hearted taskmaster. He didn't seem the type to have an open mind or an open heart, and I would never have guessed that a black student would say what Shirley Douglas was about to say next.
And the principal at that time at Coffey really made us feel good. It was Ralph Smith, and he would, really made us feel really good at that time. He really did. He didn't see any difference. You know, the way, if he saw somebody else doing something, he treated us the same way he treated the others. He didn't make any difference. When we had senior skip day, we all got treated the same way on senior skip day.
Prom, after school dances, after school activities.
After school activities,
they
everything.
Were diverse.
Senior skip day.
Okay, I have to tell you now, the city and the county were dry, no alcohol. So we teens would drive to Tennessee to buy booze. Sadly, it seemed like every year the high school would lose one student to drunk driving. Now, we always figured no one would ever do anything about that. But here's what Shirley Douglas said happened when she and the other seniors on skip day headed to the state line to buy alcohol. Guess who showed up driving a Joiner's school bus?
It was Ralph Smith. He came up there and picked us up.
Really?
Yes. He picked us up on a Joiner's bus, and we had just bought some beer. He made us pour it all out and made us get on the bus one by one and then made us call our parents and tell them.
Oh, that's a good story. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Sharon.
All right, good.
My co-host, Sharonda Allen, invited up our next guest, Billy Ray Warren. He's white, by the way. And maybe he'll tell us that we're exaggerating how well everyone got along during integration.
I met Mr. Warren after I came to the newspaper, but he has been in education ever since I've known him, as a teacher, as a curriculum director, and now as our city historian.
Thank you for inviting me, yes.
Where were you at the time integration was going on?
I was teaching at Coffey High School. I began in 1962 at Coffey, and so I was teaching when all the freedom of choice business began, and in 1966, I believe it was, I taught my first African-American students. And I really echo what Shirley said. There was never a wrinkle, we just moved on.
How did you learn that you were about to be integrated, about to teach a diverse class? Did they tell you anything ahead of time as to the attitudes to expect or not to expect?
They didn't make any big deal of it, but we had conversations about it, but there was never any, we're about to be enter a period of doom or anything like that at all.
Any misgivings.
And I don't mean to
line.
Minimize either. I'm with you. I want to know, the buried truths as you're talking about. But in my own personal experience, there was never a wrinkle. You know, what is really interesting, too, during that from, say, 1966 to 69, there was an exchange of teachers between Coffey and Burl Slater, Coffey and Bradshaw and Burl Slater. I know that Tira Hitchcock, for example, a white teacher, went to Burl part of the day and taught art there. And to this day, there's a mural on the wall in the Burl Slater building that she and the Burl Slater students did using cast-off tile from Stylon, which is now Monarch Tile. And it tells the story of W.C. Handy's life, and it's still on the wall at the Burl Slater building, and it's going to stay there as far as I'm concerned. Yeah, yeah.
Those remarks from Billy Ray Warren. Now, W.C. Handy is one of Florence's greatest claims to fame. He was, of course, father of the blues. He made his name big in Memphis, but he was from Florence. And in fact, his birth home is still there, and it's located only a 3-minute walk from that mural in the old Burl Slater High School, which is now an active community education center. This is a special episode of Buried Truths, recorded live in my hometown, Florence, Alabama.
Support for WABE comes from 100 Miles, a nonprofit committed to preserving Georgia's 100-mile coast. Protecting this critical coastal ecosystem takes all of us. Watch the stories of the innovators and future leaders who help keep our coast flowing at ourgeorgiacoast.org.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
This is Buried Truths. I'm Hank Klibanoff. So in the first part of our program, I talked about some of my memories of my home area as being racially progressive. And I think it probably was. I mean, what I saw certainly reflected that, but I have to acknowledge that I might have had a distorted view because inside my own household, I was surrounded by parents and siblings who were very progressive. I mean, my father, who had a couple of stores on the main street in town, ladies' clothing and shoes and a family shoe store, hired the first black sales clerk in town. And it happened with little notice, little attention. There was nothing in the newspaper. He didn't talk about it. It just happened. And it worked beautifully. So before I said I don't know what I don't know, now I know what I know, and it's from my parents. But I haven't gotten yet into why Florence and the Shoals region were different. Now, there's not going to be any single reason. There's going to be a gathering of them. A lot of it, most of it, has to do with the people there. But even that doesn't explain why these people were here. What brought them together at this place and at that time? Why would my grandparents, whose names were Hyman and Lily Klibanoff, a few years removed from Russia, go to Florence and build a life there? I mentioned at the beginning of this program that Florence sits along the Tennessee River. That river. Oh, that river. Well, it explains everything here. For almost as many years as my family has been in Florence, and that's 102 years, that river, visible from my backyard on a winter's day, has done something we viewed as miraculous. Follow me on this. The river flows full bore into a dam where it turns giant blades that spin a generator inside of a turbine that produces cheap, water-powered electricity. That dam, Wilson Dam, was part of a series of dams on the Tennessee River that comprised the Tennessee Valley Authority, TVA. And throughout history, TVA has provided inexpensive electricity for millions of people. So why am I telling you this? Remember my observation and memory that my hometown was more progressive in the worst days of the civil rights struggle than in the rest of Alabama. Well, the Tennessee River and TVA are key to my theory on why. Start with this. TVA is, plain and simple, government-owned electricity. When Congress debated in the 1930s whether to fund it, opponents tagged it with that stink bomb of a word, socialism. But Congress funded TVA, built it, and put it and some ancillary businesses into operation. And that, in turn, every week, put generous federal dollars into the pockets of thousands of people who worked for TVA over the decades. So it's a little harder to develop a hatred for the federal government, as many Southerners did, when it's paying your salary. The second thing going on is this. When you can offer electricity that is cheaper than anywhere else in the United States, you can draw industries that use a lot of electricity to run shifts day and night. That's what TVA did, and it's why Ford Motor Company, Reynolds Aluminum, Diamond Alkali, and other companies came to the Shoals region, developed a well-paid workforce, and brought with them an executive presence that would have cultural influence in the area. These people Ford brought in from Detroit, they were pretty smart, pretty enlightened people. Even Mrs. Tauber, who, when she saw me, loved to humiliate me by asking me to pronounce my first name, Hank. Why? Because I had a way, as a child, of stretching my one-syllable name into a southernized three syllables, Hank. Now, TVA had a facility called the International Fertilizer Development Corporation. Could you imagine anything more boring than fertilizer development? Well, it's not boring at all if you're an Israeli scientist looking for a way to make the deserts bloom, or an agronomist from Africa seeking to crack the code on growing crops in a parched land, or from the waterlogged Netherlands where crops want to float away. People from across the world came to town and lived and worked there for weeks, months, and years, and wearing dashikis or yarmulkes or Euro-style shirts, they brought bits and pieces of their cultures with them into the homes of those of us who invited them over. In my hometown, guess what else they found? Pre-existing cultural energy in community theater. Even an opera series that brought in stars like Beverly Sills, Richard Tucker, and Isaac Stern. These people from the outside, joined by open-minded people already in Florence, brought a different perspective on just about everything. Many of you may have seen a terrific documentary titled Muscle Shoals about all the great music of the 50s, 60s, 70s that came out of a handful of small studios in the Shoals. The film, by way of explaining why Aretha Franklin, the Rolling Stones, Wilson Pickett, Paul Simon, the Staples Singers, and so many others would come to the Shoals, cited a Native American tale of an Indian maiden who lived in the Tennessee River and sang. Now, I love this film, but not that premise. Not to be a skeptic, but I've never seen her, so I'm dubious. No, there was a native tolerance that inspired and attracted people to this region. It inspired and attracted big thinking, open minds, and rhythm, and blues, and soul. Oh, let me tell you about one more historical influence in the Shoals. Only 6 miles from the library, in the town of Tuscumbia, is Ivy Green, the birthplace of one of the world's greatest humanists, Helen Keller. Next, we speak with Gwen Woods. In the first year of integration, 1966, Gwen enrolled in the previously all-white junior high, Appleby, Flavius T. Appleby, to be precise. And her older sister, Sandra, was among the first black seniors to transfer from Burl Slater to Coffey. So I asked Gwen how her parents coached them both as they headed off to learn at all-white schools.
My parents set us down and talked to all of us. My sister, my oldest sibling, graduated from Burl in 65.
Okay.
So in 66, we all, it was freedom of choice. My parents received all of this paperwork and they asked us if we wanted to go. So that would be Sandra at Coffey, my brother Derek at Richards, and I went to Appleby Junior High. So the situation was, if you want to go, we would like for you to go. We want you to have the same education that they have. And we all agreed, yes, we wanted to do that. Mm-hmm. And Sandra, my sister Sandra, never came home to say anything negative that was going on at Coffey High School. My perspective is a lot different from Shirley's, because you have to understand, I went to Appleby Junior High School and then Coffey High School. Therefore, when that was freedom of choice, so when it was what I call forced integration, when the students from Burl came over to Coffey, I had already been to school with all of the white children, students, from eighth grade. So, and I did experience wrinkles I did at Appleby. It was a situation where it was like it was a programmed politeness.
Can you show us what that looked like? I mean,
for example, right.
It was a good morning. It was. Have you ever seen people give you the smile like? Have you seen it? It was that type of smiles. When I said politeness, it was polite. I share with so many people today that I am so comfortable going out to eat by myself, going to a movie by myself, and I contribute that to when I was at Appleby, I sat at a table by myself and ate. And so many times, Ralph Smith was the assistant principal, and so many times he would come and sit with me.
Really?
Yes.
Okay, sorry. You heard my disbelief that Ralph Smith, the old basketball coach, did that. And honestly, I couldn't be happier with this dawning realization that I was just plain wrong about him.
Now, were you the only black student at Appleby, or where were the other black students?
There were probably about 12 or 13 black students at Appleby Junior High. But, then the next year I went to Coffee.
Mm-hmm. Was it vastly different at Coffee?
No.
Because that same group from Appleby was with you at Coffee, and it went that way your whole high school career?
No. I became friends with several white students mm-hmm. as the time progressed. And I was very active in school. I was in the choir. I was in the drama club. I was active in so many different things in at Coffee High School. And unlike Shirley, I did try out for cheerleader.
Well, was there this general sense that when it comes to things like that, or the homecoming court, or the most popular, all those different things, that there was a cap on?
Well, I was voted friendliest of my class. I was also, and this is very, very, according to the Coffee Pot school book and according to the Times Daily newspaper, I was first runner up to Miss Coffee High School. However, after it was all said and done, one of the white teachers pulled me to the side and said, "You were actually Miss Coffee High School, but Mr. Coffee High School was white, and they didn't feel like the community would accept a black Miss Coffee High School with a white Mr. Coffee High School. So therefore, I was first runner up to Miss Coffee High School." So,
did you have a hard time accepting that?
Well, it was over when I found out, and I tell everybody today, I was Miss Coffee High School.
Did you ever carry any of those incidents home and talk to your parents about them, the eating along at the lunch table, the not being Miss Coffee High School?
I did not. I did not.
Why is that?
It was a situation where, like I said, my parents set us down and we wanted to do this. And I never wanted to make them worry, I guess. And it really didn't, what harm did it do? I mean, I ate alone or with Mr. Smith, so therefore it was okay. Like I said earlier, they wanted the best for us. They wanted us to experience the education that they did not have and maybe something better than we were getting at that particular time. We didn't think of it as children. We didn't think that, but my parents thought, okay, in this situation, everybody thinks that the school books are better at the predominantly white schools, and the black schools got the books that were
2 or 3 years behind.
Yes. And it's one thing my dad said. He said, when you go to that school, just know that you are as good as anybody else. Now, don't ever think that you are better than anybody, but no one is any better than you are. And so that just always stuck in my mind.
I told Hank earlier that my very first day of school as a six-year-old, I've come from an all-black community to this school. I looked to my right, and there sits this girl with the reddest hair I had ever seen and stuff on her face that I found out later in life that's called freckles. But I thought she was the most beautiful little girl I had ever seen. And Carla and I, by recess time, were holding hands and skipping and playing and having a great time. But that drew a line somewhere that I crossed with the other black students there, because there was still this fear, or I hate to say resentment. I don't even know what the word is. As a six-year-old, I can't grab the word. But I crossed a line with Carla that day that I had a very hard time dealing with both sides. Now, I had friends that told me a lot of times that I was not welcome at their home, even though they played with me at recess. But I can't bring you home. My parents won't allow that. Okay. We were raised to be polite children. Maybe that's why we didn't have the problems in the streets and that kind of thing that Birmingham and other places witnessed. Because our parents raised us, don't make trouble. Be polite. Carry yourself well. You're not better than anybody, but you're not worse than anybody. And just treat everybody like you want it to be treated. So I did that, but I caught flack for it for a lot of years, you know, from both sides.
We're going to turn now just briefly to a different subject that the library had been developing over several events, and that's voting rights.
Voter suppression remains a big issue here in Alabama. Certainly it does in Georgia, I know. What's going on here?
Alabama, not too long ago, tried to make it difficult for a lot of our densely populated areas with black residents, difficult to get voter ID or photo ID. They tried to close down a lot of the agencies that issued photo IDs, and it was, to me anyway, and I'm sure to others, it was as a way to keep them from voting. But that kind of backfired on them, and they had to open them back up again. But it still goes on, and it's so, I don't know, you think it's just the 21st century, why is it still going on? But there are very subtle ways, it seems now. Some literacy tests are still going on in parts of the world. I just don't understand why it is still going on in the 21st century. I know when I first voted, I know, I have to admit, I was a stupid 18-year-old. I voted for Jimmy Carter, 1980, just because he was a Southerner. You know, I didn't know issues, but I was.
Well, he was the only candidate who didn't have an accent.
Right. Okay. I understood him. Right. But it was such a thrill to walk into that voter's booth and do this thing that my parents had always instilled in me that was a privilege and my right to do.
Sharonda then invited to the stage a longtime civic leader and city council member, Sam Pendleton.
Mr. Sam Pendleton, I met Mr. Pendleton also. When I became a journalist, I left the farm and came to the big city and became a journalist and met all these really fascinating people, and Mr. Pendleton was one of them. He's a former educator, science teacher, terrific science teacher, but he's also a long-term president of our local NAACP chapter and a long-term city councilman for the city of Florence. 28 years.
Never missed a meeting.
Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Tell me, Mr. Pendleton, if you would, about voter registration here in your capacity as an NAACP president.
Let me tell you, voter registration here is very easy.
Now, Sam Pendleton says that he has tested voting registration and voting itself, and he's found it to be an easy process. He's quite praiseworthy of the willingness of white people over the years to ensure fair elections. And he particularly singled out the League of Women Voters.
Because they saw a need and they saw people were interested in doing things.
Right,
what I'm trying to say is, it is a difference in this area. Most blacks in other parts of Alabama had to go to court to get what we got free just by asking for it. That's what I'm saying. It's free.
Sam Pendleton summed up his attitude, and more importantly, his experience, this way.
The question was, is the Shoals area different in the civil rights movement as other part of the state and country? The answer is yes. The people in this area will work with you if you allow them to work with you. Listen, I'm a living witness.
All right. Well, thank you. This Absolutely. Is fantastic, and we'll have more questions later. So now we're going to go to Q&A. Am I right? Oh, it's your turn.
The first person to stand, I was pleased to see, was Alvin Rosenbaum. He's my first cousin, who grew up in the only home in Alabama designed by Frank Lloyd Wright. And he's got an amazing story to tell about desegregation of the library where we're meeting.
Both our fathers, at one time or another, were part of the Florence Lauderdale Public Library Board. And the building behind us, a block away, was built in 1948. And there was an African-American library next to the county jail over on Pine Street, across town. And the roof was falling in, and the books were getting wet. And the part-time librarian called my father, who was the treasurer at the time, and said they were going to need a new roof. And they got a bid that was higher than the whole building was worth. So the board met here, the library board, and they decided that we are here in the Shoals in Florence, we're part of Jim Crow laws of the state, which meant separate restrooms, separate water fountains, lots and lots of issues of public accommodations and so on. But they did a little research and discovered that if they turned off the water fountain and locked the restrooms, they weren't breaking the law. And in 1954 or 55, this library, this organization, integrated without water fountains or restrooms. And it didn't appear in the paper. There was no discussion about it. It just happened.
It just happened. Well, it sure seemed that way, of course. But there were plenty of wise leaders quietly turning dials and pulling levers behind the scenes. So, for example, in 1953, before Emmett Till or Rosa Parks, the all-white medical society in my home county, Lauderdale, voted to admit a black physician. That was Dr. L.J. Hicks, and he was the first in all of Alabama to be admitted to a county medical society. And what that meant was that he could treat patients in the local hospital, in fact, the hospital where I was born, the same as white doctors. And something else that seemed to just happen quietly. Everyone knows about the Montgomery bus boycott of 1955-56. The bus company there was intractable. Blacks had to sit in the back, whites in the front. So starting with Rosa Parks, blacks staged a boycott, sued, and it took 381 days and a Supreme Court decision to overturn that. But here's what is less known. At the same time that was happening in Montgomery, the bus company that operated in Florence and the Shoals voluntarily stopped enforcing racial segregation. Passengers could sit where they wanted, and there was no protest, no boycott, no demonstration. The change came peacefully. Now, before we get back to the library, there's just one thing I want to add here. Florence leaders showed through the decades that they were not going to let the most entrenched and violent white supremacists get a foothold. The library's historian, Lee Friedman, tells us that the Ku Klux Klan tried three times to get leverage in Florence, twice in the 1920s and then in 1980, but faced opposition from political figures, newspaper editors, and civic organizations, so they got little or no traction.
Well, right here.
I'm Alan Flowers, and the ladies over there I remember from Coffee High School. I taught at Coffee and Bradshaw, and one year at Burroughs Slater, I was the only white teacher there. But Mr. Lewis, the wonderful principal, we got together somehow, I can't remember, and I said we need to have a chorus at Burroughs Slater. And so I went out one period, I think on Tuesday and Thursday, and we had the chorus, which was a wonderful group of singers, of course. And when those people began to come to Coffee and Bradshaw, we got many of them into the chorus. Couldn't get any men, but we got the ladies. And I think we need to acknowledge Ralph Smith and Joe Brewer and Eddie Frost, who were the movers and shakers at Coffee and Bradshaw during this time.
Let me insert here that these three men were coaches who had clout and who became school administrators. One even became the mayor of Florence.
And there was a lot of discussion amongst the faculty in faculty meetings and in the faculty lounge. Is it working? What can we do different if we need to do anything? And I think the leadership of those people is the reason that it was so smooth, and we need to give them
very
credit
for that. Thank you. Thank you. Okay. Please.
Not so much a question, just want to share a couple of experiences.
Please.
My name is Tori Bailey. I was a child at Kilby School, one of the few black children at that school. You could count us on one hand. I remember my mom telling me about one of the student teachers. We were guinea pigs over at Kilby, and the student teachers would come over from the University of North Alabama and practice on us. And there was one student teacher who recommended a book to my little brother. She pulled Sambo out of the school library, okay? And he took it home, not knowing, not thinking anything of it. And my mom said, "What made you choose this book?" And he said, "Well, my teacher picked this book for me." And so my mom took that book back to school the next day and said, "You know, I think we'll find another book." And she pulled the teacher aside and said, "What made you choose this particular book for my child?" That didn't happen again. So there were some things that you just had, you know, it wasn't always overt. Sometimes it was subtle, but it did exist.
Yeah.
And I think the more we know about each other, the more we have conversations like this one, the more we learn about each other, the more we'll find that we have way more in common than we do that divides us.
Thank you very much. You know, I want to say among our guests here tonight, Wendell Gunn, may I introduce you?
I was thrilled to see in the audience a man I've heard about for something like 60 years, but had never met, Wendell Wilkie Gunn. He was the first black person to enroll at the university in Florence. That was Florence State College, and then it was Florence State University, and now the University of North Alabama. Now, that's a state university, and in 1963, with George Wallace as governor, Wendell Gunn and his mother did have to sue to get him in. Well, how did that turn out?
I'll just say I'm impressed with what I've heard tonight. I wasn't here during the time that we're talking about, and I didn't know what kinds of things she were going through. I went to UNA in 1963 after suing in federal court to get in. And consistent with some of the things that I've heard tonight, even though when it was known that I had applied and been turned down, even though I got some threatening phone calls about rifles being pointed at my head, we still sued and I still went, because nothing, in spite of those calls, nothing that had ever happened to me in my growing up in Tuscumbia ever made me think anything bad like that would ever happen to me. Now, I know that's a little naive looking at it back 57 years, but I did go to UNA. My first year there, I sang in the choir from day one. And when George Wallace came for Governor's Day, we sang a song, "I Wonder As I Wonder," and there was a soprano solo and a tenor solo. And guess who had the tenor solo?
Good. Thank you. That's good.
And when it was all over, the convocation was all over, when the governor was standing there talking to all the important people, he looked over and saw me about 30 feet away. And he walked away from that group over to me and reached his hand out to shake hands and said, "Good job." Scared me. All I could say was, "Thank you, sir." And anyway, after I won the Physics Achievement Award in the spring, my life turned around on the campus because the people who hadn't been speaking to me for 8 months stood up and cheered.
Ooh, nice.
For 3 minutes. I lost my composure completely, and it just got louder and louder. And I said, "Well, maybe not everybody white is out to get me." In the spring of the next year, I closed the talent show with a medley of modern sounds in country and western music in the style of Ray Charles. I left after I graduated, went to Chicago where I had some relatives so I could go to school at night and get a soft landing. And that was my Florence State experience, except that now I'm still coming back 4 times a year because I'm on the Board of Trustees.
All right.
You heard that? The first black person to enter the University of North Alabama now sits on the university's Board of Trustees. He's now a retired corporate executive, and he served, interestingly, in the Reagan White House as a special international trade representative.
Thank you. Thank you.
Sharonda and I have something in common. We have both worked at the local newspaper here, the Florence newspaper, the Times Daily. When I worked here, it was as a summer intern. Sharonda has been the city editor for some time now, but she had some early experiences that weren't altogether pleasant.
As the first brown-skinned person at the Times Daily, for instance, at a time when this community was not used to that, a professional journalist, the sound of my voice does not give away the fact that I'm black. I mean, we hear that a lot. "Oh, I can't tell you're black by talking to you." Well, I was on the phone first, making appointments with people to come and see them and interview them for stories. And then I would show up, and the front door would open, and I get this look, "Oh, I didn't know you were a," and the door would slam. I had to do that every week. So whatever topic, whatever subject of truth that you're trying to unbury, that's the kind of courage sometimes. I'm not saying that I was very courageous. I was about ready to run back to the farm that I grew up on as a little girl where it was safe and secure and my parents were there and give up. I don't know why I didn't. I really don't. Except that every day I wanted to write someone's story. I wanted to tell someone's story. People are fascinating even when they're evil. And I wanted to tell stories. So I went back the next week and the next week and the next week. And after a while, the doors stopped slamming in my face.
Yeah, please.
In reference to a lot of discussion dealing with like historic events and experiences that we're all having due to the racial tension that's building in our country, my question is, talking about everything that's been going on in the past and going on even in the present day, how much effect do you think it's going to take on the rest of the world based on the decisions that we make here in this country, especially in the South, about our racial issues?
I have hope in that just because of the fact that this podcast is not going to stop here. It is going nationwide. Hopefully, more discussions like this where others can hear that we can be civil, we can share our experiences without being angry at each other. We can be shocked at each other's experiences when they're bad. We can be happy when each other's experiences are good. More conversations like this has got to make a way into some of that fog that's hanging over our world right now when it comes to race relations. So every chance we get, we need to be out there calmly, but positively talking to other people about our experiences. And it's an experience that's my truth. It's an experience that his truth is an experience that's your truth. My brother, for instance, as a black man, has a way different story than I have because it's a different struggle for him as a black man. But he also has good stories to tell. So I think more podcasts like this that goes forward and goes out into the nation, not just here in the shows, but goes over the United States, little bitty ripples is what I have a hope in. That the ripples expand.
So that's Sharonda Allen, a top editor of the Times Daily in Florence, Alabama. I've enjoyed co-hosting this wonderful evening with her. Now, I need to tell you that Florence today is not the Florence I knew in the 1950s and 60s. Those big companies I was telling you about, they're all gone. But the Tennessee River and TVA, they're still rolling. The college, the University of North Alabama, is growing by the day. And there's still a lively and influential live music and recording scene in the Shoals area. Two of the hottest fashion designers in the U.S., Billy Reed and Natalie Shannon, are based here. In fact, I saw Natalie in our audience at the library. Florence these days shows up in an impressive number of magazine stories about the best small towns in the South. And they've still got the best lunch counter and chili dog in America at Trowbridge's. Now, there's another well-known restaurant there, Odette. If you get there, stop in the entryway and look down at the mosaic. It was put there in the early 1900s, and it says Kay's, K-A-Y-E, apostrophe S. So who was Kay? Well, he was my grandfather. People in town called him Mr. K, because I guess Klibanoff didn't exactly roll off the Alabama tongue. And he named the family shoe store K's. My father, also known as Mr. K, and his brother-in-law owned it next. I worked there most Saturdays growing up. Then I even became part owner of the store after my father died. Now I go to that place to eat at Odette. I love that town, Florence, and I was grateful to be able to return there, to engage in a conversation that looked back to a terribly difficult time in Alabama and U.S. history. A lot of things went on that we cannot be proud of. But on this night, in Florence and at the library, we had a good and civil conversation as we shared experiences that were and that remained common across both real and imaginary race lines. And I cannot tell you how pleased I was, thrilled really, to discover that among all the things that many of us in Alabama did wrong back in those days, there was a genuine basis for that, you know, that something that I mentioned to you at the beginning of this program. That something being my observation and my memory and my theory that we in Florence and the Shoals, with no doubt plenty of exceptions, handled the racial dynamics well, with open minds and open hearts. As we close, we'd like to give a sincere thanks to the Florence Lauderdale Public Library and to Abby Carpenter, Jennifer Butler Keaton, Benita Logsdon, and Chris Ferguson. We'd also like to thank Counts Brothers Music and Grant Walden for the sound equipment and recording. This event was sponsored by the Alabama Humanities Foundation, a state partner with the National Endowment for the Humanities, the University of North Alabama Mitchell West Center for Social Inclusion, and the University of North Alabama Department of Communications. I'm Hank Klibanoff. Buried Truths is a production of WABE Atlanta.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Have you donated to WABE yet? I know you've heard us talking about why it's important, but it doesn't have to be this big decision. You can give at whatever amount fits your budget. It can be a spur-of-the-moment thing. You already get so much out of public radio, so just go for it. Visit wabe.org/donate and become a member right now. And thank you.